Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Thomas Sariti. Among our stories tonight, the federal opposition continues to target the Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, calling on him to stand aside from Cabinet until doubts about his constitutional qualifications have been resolved. And concerns that just 1 in 10 kids in some remote Indigenous communities meet the minimum standards for reading and writing.
The statistics are pretty appalling, and there's been no major change. And if anyone looks at the NAPLAN results for the last 10 years, it's appalling that a wealthy country like Australia should have such shocking statistics.
Labor has lived up to its promise to heap more pain on the coalition over its constitutional crisis. The opposition wants the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, to stand aside while the High Court examines his eligibility to stand in Parliament. During question time, it used parliamentary tactics to try to cause mayhem, but that was dismissed by the Prime Minister, who likened the attack to being flogged with a wet lettuce. From Canberra, Stephanie Dalzell reports.
The opposition manager of business, Tony Burke, has been building up to this moment for a few days.
Stand him aside. Stand him aside. If you had any courage, if you had any authority, you would have done it more than a fortnight ago.
Labor has been disrupting parliamentary proceedings to protest against Barnaby Joyce remaining in cabinet while the High Court decision hangs in the balance. And today the party showed they are nothing if not consistent, focusing again on the government's citizenship woes.
It's no small matter when the Constitution says you probably shouldn't be here.
And heckling Barnaby Joyce as he tried to speak.
Mr Speaker, I thank the honourable member for his question. And isn't it amazing? It's a disgrace.
The
disgrace
what Deputy Prime Minister resume his seat.
Once again, Tony Burke moved to suspend standing orders.
The House calls on the Deputy Prime Minister to stand aside from Cabinet until doubts about his constitutional qualifications have been resolved.
Labor's motion was unlikely to succeed. The Coalition still has a slim but very important one-vote majority. But it gave the opposition valuable time to pursue the government. Time Labor frontbencher Joel Fitzgibbon was all too happy to take.
What we don't know, Mr Speaker, is why the Deputy Prime Minister is hanging on. Well, I think we know the answer to that question in part because we know that when he travelled to Canberra to share the bad news with the Prime Minister, he came down here with every intention of resigning and going to a by-election in New England. But the Prime Minister said, oh no, there won't be any of that. There won't be any of that because I need your vote in the House of Representatives to survive.
For the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, the debate was a chance to take a break from the big topics of the day, like North Korea.
What we've had from the opposition instead is these big threats of creating chaos and mayhem in the Parliament. An absolutely swingy question time strategy. We felt battered by it over here, Mr Speaker. It was like being flogged with a wet lettuce.
And exercise his old debating skills against the member for Hunter, Joel Fitzgibbon.
The House has urgent matters to discuss. Energy prices, jobs. We've just heard from the member for Hunter, who claims, apparently, that Section 44 is the leading topic of conversation in his electorate. I tell you what, Mr Speaker, I know what the topic is. The topic is why he has abandoned the workers at Liddell. Why he's abandoned the workers at Tomago.
While the first speaker of a debate gets to set the agenda, the final speaker always gets the last say. And the Prime Minister chose to end today's political battle with questions about the nation's energy supply through to 2022 and beyond.
Stephanie Dalzell with that report. Grassroots National Party members will use a gathering in Canberra this weekend to call for an energy policy to be finalised. It's the party's federal conference, and there'll be a push for more coal-fired power plants to be built in regional areas. Excessive electricity bills have hit rural businesses and households hard, and senior National Party figures say urgent action is needed. Here's Regional Affairs reporter Lucy Barber.
Every 3 years, the entire Nationals membership converges on the capital to dance, drink and, most of all, debate. It's their federal conference and a chance for honest, robust discussion that helps form party policy.
The message from the people, which is the message we get as local members, is the same. Enough's enough. This has to be dealt with, and it needs to be dealt with urgency.
Nationals MP and the member for the coastal Queensland seat of Hinkler, Keith Pitt, says this year energy will be the hot topic.
My view, and certainly what's been promoted to me by my constituents and others, is no one cares whose fault it is, but it needs to be sorted out. From the newest newborn to the most senior, people cannot afford to pay their electricity and it affects them.
The looming problem for the Turnbull government is the clean energy target. It'd force energy companies to provide a percentage of power from low emissions technology like renewables or gas. It's being fiercely contested by some in the coalition's right wing, but the Prime Minister is expected to deal with the issue by the end of the year. None of the Nationals' motions this weekend advocate in support of a clean energy target. Instead, there's a call for the government to urgently adopt a comprehensive energy supply policy that would rely on a mix of coal, renewables, clean coal technologies and nuclear power.
People are telling me they are completely dismayed by the lack of progress on providing reliable baseload energy that they need in their communities. And they know and they understand that part of the mix is going to have to be coal for the immediate future and perhaps into the longer term as well.
Darren Chester is the member for Gippsland, where the Latrobe Valley's Hazelwood coal-fired power station was decommissioned earlier this year. He welcomes a motion from the Young Nationals for a new, more efficient coal plant to be built in Hazelwood's place.
We can build more efficient coal-fired power stations now than we could back in the 70s and 80s, and we should be doing it.
He concedes that business wouldn't invest in new coal-fired plants, but he argues that policy certainty would solve that. Keith Pitt believes construction of new coal plants is a viable long-term option, but he also wants to see more immediate action.
The NEM has been a complete failure. The national market has not worked because it's eliminated competition.
Mr. Pitt wants the federal government to intervene in the national electricity market to try to bring prices down.
Well, there's currently a market cap for a peak, which is $14,000 a megawatt hour. I think we need to intervene and make that something much, much less. Now, what that number is dependent, of course, on an assessment of the generators and what their capacity is to manage a set low price. But I think somewhere between $65 and $75 a megawatt hour is not out of the ballpark.
His Queensland colleague, David Littleproud, the member for Maranoa, agrees that state governments are profiteering from the energy market. It's why he's pushing for energy company CS Energy to double the size of Australia's newest coal-fired power station, Kogan Creek, on Queensland's Darling Downs.
The issue is that CS Energy is owned by the Queensland State Government. And the Queensland State Government has become accustomed to the $1.5 billion in dividends that they are taking out of the government-owned corporations in Queensland to prop up their financial mismanagement. And the reality is they can't wean themselves off that.
The Nationals' federal conference begins on Friday night.
Regional Affairs reporter Lucy Barber. The leaders of small Pacific Island countries say Australia's continuing support of coal as a source of energy and export revenue is causing resentment in the region. The concerns have been raised as leaders gather in Samoa for the annual Pacific Islands Forum. Pacific Affairs reporter Liam Fox is in the capital, Apia.
Bare-chested, traditionally tattooed Samoan men gave a warm welcome at the opening of this year's Pacific Islands Forum. But behind closed doors, Australia, the forum's largest and wealthiest member, can expect some blunt talk on the subject of climate change.
Australia is moving and supporting actions that are creating the cause of the possible demise of my people. I don't understand.
Eneli Sopoanga is the Prime Minister of Tuvalu. Tuvalu and other small Pacific nations are among the world's most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Islanders see it as a threat to their very survival. So, when they hear news out of Australia about the approval of the massive Adani coal mine and of support among some Conservative MPs for a new coal-fired power station, it hurts.
It creates some sort of distrust amongst us whether we should trust on this commitment to regional cooperation or there could be some sort of hidden agenda going on.
The federal government provides tens of millions of dollars to help Pacific nations address the challenges posed by climate change. As co-chair of the Green Climate Fund, Australia has helped to funnel millions more into the region. Mr. Sopawanga is grateful for Australia's help, but says it's undermined by its continued support of coal as a source of energy and export revenue.
There is resentment, strong resentment and strong disapproval of these double standards. And it's as if we are children, to be misled and say, okay, you have this piece of cake, you don't talk about these things. We are not, and Tuvalu is not.
The Prime Minister of Cook Islands, Henry Puna, is more diplomatic, but he shares the concerns about Australia's continued support of coal.
You know, I respect Australia's position and priorities, but then, you know, we all know that using coal for energy is one of the biggest polluters in the world. And we're not just talking about climate change for the benefit of the Pacific Islands. Goodness sake, you know, it's for all of us. It's for the whole world. And really, you know, we would expect these big countries like Australia to do the right thing.
The Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Concetta Fierravanti-Wells, is in Apia ahead of the arrival of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull later in the week. In response to the concerns of Pacific leaders, she highlights Australia's commitment to cut its carbon emissions under the Paris Agreement.
Australia will meet its commitment and will meet those commitments within our own framework. And we're also encouraging and supportive of other countries in our region to help them get their national plans up and running to meet their commitments.
Climate change is just one of many issues Mr. Turnbull will discuss when he arrives for the leaders' retreat on Friday. Also on the agenda is a proposal for a new regional security agreement to allow collective responses to events like natural disasters. This is Liam Fox in Apia reporting for PM.
The Anglican Church has revealed that it's preparing to join the Commonwealth Redress Scheme for victims of child sexual abuse. At its triennial meeting in Queensland, the church's General Synod has voted to set up an independent company to handle complaints and compensation. And while that doesn't mean the church has joined the scheme, it says the new company could enable it to do so. The move comes about 5 months since the church last appeared at the Child Abuse Royal Commission and a year since a damning public hearing examining the Anglican Diocese of Newcastle in New South Wales. For more, I spoke to Garth Blake, the chairman of the National Royal Commission Working Group within the Anglican Church of Australia, and I began by asking him whether this new company would be truly independent.
The constitution still has to be settled, but the intention is that it will have functional independence, which means the management or the board will be completely independent of the church.
And will it be entirely funded by the church?
Yes. Although we are opening up the possibility to other Christian bodies or indeed non-Christian bodies to become members.
If it's going to be entirely funded by the church, are you concerned that that could compromise the company's independence?
I don't think so. I mean, this is just money to run it. It has to be run. No one else is going to put their hands in their pockets to run it. I think the important area of independence is at management level, and it's intended that at that point the church will have no power of control, veto, and the board within the constitution will be mandated to be independent. That's the intention.
The Catholic Church has done something similar by setting up an independent company and naming and shaming church bodies as part of that. Will the Anglican Church take a similar approach in terms of the public dissemination of information relating to child sexual abuse within the church?
We have passed another piece of legislation called the Safe Ministry to Children Canon. Part of its role will be to ensure that standards for screening and training where there's sex offenders in parishes audited by an independent person and those audit results will be made publicly available. I mean, I guess one way of putting it could be name and shame, but I'd like to see it also as continuous improvement.
And you note that the church has announced it's preparing to join the redress scheme. Why hasn't the church gone as far as to say that it is joining?
We have not seen the Commonwealth legislation. We don't know what its provisions are. We don't know what its cost is going to be in terms of administration sense. And there are some key issues that we are concerned that by joining the Commonwealth scheme, it won't prejudice some other matters. I can give you an example. We understand that information within the scheme is to be confidential. We hope that that would not prevent us, where an alleged perpetrator is in a position of responsibility that involving contact with children, that we would not be able to take protective measures. That there are issues like that, as far as the administration of the scheme, that we need to have clear details on.
With those concerns in mind, though, the federal government announced the Commonwealth Redress Scheme in November last year. Why has it taken so long for the Anglican Church to make this commitment?
Well, look, we meet as a national synod every 3 years or so. This was the first one since then. We, like other non-government groups, have been in contact with the Commonwealth through the Department of Social Services. We've been involved in three meetings where issues around the architecture of the scheme have been discussed.
Garth Blake, the chairman of the National Royal Commission Working Group within the Anglican Church of Australia. In some remote parts of Australia, just 1 in 10 Indigenous school students meet the national minimum standard for reading and writing. That's according to the Indigenous Literacy Foundation. And today, the group has launched 4 books around the country aimed at turning that figure around. Penny Timms reports.
Here at the Sydney Opera House, there's excitement in the air. The foyers are filled with hundreds of school students here to launch a book that some have had a hand in creating. Others are here for a massive book swap. And it's a scene being repeated around Australia.
We've got 4 books being launched, and they represent stories written by children and elders from over 15 remote communities.
Karen Williams is the Executive Director of the Indigenous Literacy Foundation.
Our vision is equity of opportunity, and that's about giving every child who lives in a remote community the same opportunities and access to literacy resources so that they're, we believe, through education, they will improve their access to jobs, well-being and health.
Can you just give me a bit of a snapshot of where we're up to at the moment, especially when it does come to literacy for Indigenous students?
The statistics are pretty appalling, and there's been no major change. And if anyone looks at the NAPLAN results for the last 10 years, it's appalling that a wealthy country like Australia should have such shocking statistics. Only 1 in 10 children living in a remote community in the Northern Territory, for example, can read or write at the basic minimum level.
Here in Sydney, elders and students from Yakinara in WA are launching their work, Yakinara Songbook. They've also been working with ARIA award-winning Aussie singer-songwriter Josh Pike, who also happens to be an Indigenous Literacy Foundation ambassador. And he's here today for a sing-along of a song they created together, which made it to number one on the kids' charts on iTunes.
Here we go. So how do you spell love?
They also performed some of their songs from their new book. Author and artist Ms. Lester, today's launch is the culmination of hard work with elders and students.
Yakinara is a beautiful little community, remote community, about 60 kilometres south of Fitzroy Crossing in the Kimberley, so it's on the northern edge of the Great Sandy Desert.
For cultural reasons, we can't use Ms. Lester's full name. And what makes this book so special is that it's made up of songs in English and, importantly, traditional language.
The most exciting thing has been to start publishing books in language, because I think for kids it's very hard to learn a language, to learn to read in a language that isn't your first language. But if you can learn to read in your language, it's going to be much better.
Elder Mary Vanby says it's important today's kids have the right communication skills so that they can ensure their stories live on.
Well, it's very important because kids have to know when they are still little to know. As they grow older, they'll pass it on to their generation.
Nationally, around 30,000 school students have taken part in today's events for Indigenous Literacy Day.
Penny Timms reporting. The United Nations chief is appealing to Myanmar to end the massacre of Muslims in the country. At least hundreds of ethnic Rohingya people have been killed in the past fortnight in Myanmar's Rakhine province, and more than 120,000 have escaped into Bangladesh, where border camps are struggling to cope with the ballooning numbers. The slaughter is being carried out by the Myanmar military. Sean Rubenstein Dunlop has been speaking with Rohingya people who have witnessed the brutality.
Anwar Hussain, not his real name, is in hiding in a village in Myanmar near the Bangladeshi border. Just 24 years old, he's been on the run since the Myanmar military began a brutal campaign against the Muslim Rohingya people a fortnight ago, burning down villages and murdering civilians in Rakhine province.
The military came and started firing and setting fire. All the villagers started to run, and including me. So in that village, sorry, can I?
Are you okay?
Yes. Okay. So can I continue?
Of course.
They come and set fire one houses, and then military starts shooting randomly at the houses with their guns, and people started running away. And some people who couldn't run, they were shot at there. I saw that, yeah. I myself somehow ran away and managed to be alive.
Anwar Hussain says he saw at least 10 people killed.
They were old people and some young people also.
He says scores of villages have been burned to the ground in the district where he's in hiding.
I'm so worried about my security, because they have been setting village after another. So this village is still safe. Still safe means nothing happened yet, but we can't say if this village will also be safe.
Is there any way of getting out?
Getting out, yes, there's a way to get out, but it depends on the armed forces. If they surround this village from every side, we can't go out.
I am deeply concerned about the security, humanitarian and human rights situation in Myanmar's Rakhine state.
Overnight, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on Myanmar to end the violence.
We are all aware of a long-standing history of discrimination, hopelessness and extreme poverty in that state. But now we are receiving constant reports of violence by Myanmar security forces, including indiscriminate attacks.
The Myanmar military says 400 people have been killed, while Rohingya activists put the death toll at more than 1,000. The figures are impossible to verify because media, aid groups and independent observers are denied access to Rakhine State.
What I saw yesterday was literally a kind of a sea of people who just are continually arriving. What we are seeing is a lot of elderly, a lot of women and a lot of children.
That's Tarana Hassan, Amnesty International's Crisis Response Director. She arrived on the Bangladeshi border yesterday, where the UN says more than 120,000 Rohingya have arrived from Myanmar in the past fortnight fleeing violence.
We've been documenting a kind of a scorched earth policy. The refugees who have arrived here in Bangladesh have been telling us that, you know, all of a sudden security forces have surrounded their villages. They shot randomly at people who were fleeing. And the evidence is consistent with those reports in that we have confirmed information now that there were bullet entry and entrance wounds in the back, which is consistent with people being run away when they're shot. And in other instances, we heard about people who were just set upon by angry mobs while security forces watched, and they were beaten with metal poles and sticks.
The scenes are very, very harrowing indeed. You see thousands and thousands of people who have marched for many, many days, some people up to 12 days from the surrounding Myanmar areas. They haven't eaten properly in days, and the terrain is extremely difficult.
Shafia Rahman is a documentary filmmaker who's been interviewing Rohingya people streaming across the Bangladeshi border.
I've seen the two people who were shot and killed at the border. I've seen many people who've been shot and injured coming into the MSF camp. There's one child who is 10 years old. Both his parents were slaughtered. He saw the slaughter of his parents with his own eyes. I've been constantly hearing stories about a particular place called Tolatuli, which is about 3 days, 4 days walk from Bangladesh border. And over a period of days, all the villagers have been put to death. The army surrounded the village. There was a Rakhine chairman who told all the villagers to assemble in a place, that their houses would be burned, but no harm would come to them. But soon after the houses had been burnt, the army started using long swords to slaughter people, including babies and children. And not only that, they burnt children alive.
Documentary filmmaker Shafir Rahman ending that report from Sean Rubenstein Dunlop. Well, the man in charge of preventing genocide at the United Nations says Myanmar is standing on the brink of genocide. Adama Dieng says the chief of Myanmar's military may face war crimes prosecution in the future for his role in the apparent ethnic cleansing. Mr. Dieng also called for Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi to use her moral authority and speak up for persecuted Rohingya. Adama Dieng spoke to Southeast Asia correspondent Liam Cochrane.
Well, there is a serious risk of ethnic cleansing. And I can say that almost all the elements of this crime of ethnic cleansing seems to be there. I think when the civilians are being persecuted based on their ethnic or religious identity, when they are being killed and forcibly transferred in a widespread or systematic manner, this could constitute ethnic cleansing and could amount to a crime against humanity. And in fact, it can be the precursor to all the egregious international crimes, and I mean genocide.
After the genocide in Rwanda, the United Nations introduced a concept called responsibility to protect. The idea being that if a sovereign state fails to protect its citizens, the UN, the international community, has an obligation, a responsibility to intervene. Where is that intervention in Myanmar?
Well, I think the message of the Secretary General was very clear. It is, of course, the primary responsibility of the Myanmar government to take action and protect its population. But if the Myanmar government is failing, the international community has the responsibility also to come and rescue those people.
What would that action, that intervention look like?
Well, I think that will be certainly to see how to assist the government of Myanmar to assume its responsibility. Because if the government is failing its responsibility due to lack of either resources or lack of capacity, the international community should help. And that is the second, in fact, pillar of the responsibility to protect. You have, of course, the third pillar, and this, which is the use of force, but I don't think we can reach that stage.
Under Myanmar's constitution, the de facto leader of the country, Aung San Suu Kyi, has very limited power over the military and over security ministries. Do you sympathise for the position that she is in her limited power to do something about this situation, or do you think she needs to do more?
Well, I do definitely sympathise with Aung San Suu Kyi. However, I do believe that she is a moral authority, and I think she should speak out.
The person who is ultimately most responsible for this, though, is the chief of the military forces, Min Aung Hlaing. What's your message to him?
He should know that if this situation is not solved, whoever is part of the commission of atrocity crimes will be called sooner or later to account. We have seen General Pinochet, who was the president of Chile, where he ended. We have seen President Habre of Chad, who was tried in Senegal 20 years after the Crimes Against Humanity committed in Chad. Sooner or later, those international crimes will have to be accounted.
Adama Dieng, Under-Secretary General of the United Nations and Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide, speaking to our Southeast Asia correspondent Liam Cochran. Officials across the Caribbean have ordered people to evacuate as they prepare for the most powerful hurricane to ever cross the Atlantic Ocean. A short time ago, the Category 5 Hurricane Irma made landfall on the islands of Antigua and Barbuda, and it's expected to strike Puerto Rico and Haiti before making landfall on the US coast this weekend. Flint Duxfield reports.
First there was Harvey, now there's Irma, an even more powerful hurricane that's battering the Caribbean with winds of up to 280 kilometres an hour and damaging storm surges. As we go to air, the island of Antigua is feeling the force of Irma. Chief Editor of the Antigua Chronicle, Angelica O'Donoghue, is prepared for the worst.
We are expecting some serious wind. We are expecting flash floods, storm surge waves as well. But to be honest, according to all the meteorologists, this storm is unprecedented.
Further west, in the Virgin Island city of Anguilla, Steve O'Donoghue says the storm is historic for the island.
I think everybody is very concerned. You know, we are very resilient people down here, but still they have never had a hurricane this strong.
Puerto Rico and the U.S. state of Florida have both declared states of emergency for what is expected to be one of the worst hurricanes to ever hit the Caribbean. Associate Professor Liz Ritchie from UNSW says residents should prepare for potentially catastrophic impacts.
If you combine a lot of rain, you combine a storm surge, and especially in areas where you've got these sort of mountainous spines going along these, you can also generate a lot of mudslides and flash flooding kinds of conditions, and that's where you really get, life-threatening situations happening.
Islands in the path of the storm will have to deal with between 20 and 50 centimetres of rain falling in a single day. But Associate Professor Ritchie says it's the storm surges which could have the most damaging impacts for low-lying islands.
They're going for, in some of the islands, 3 to 15 metres of storm surge.
15 metres of storm surge, that's gigantic.
That is huge, yeah. It's a little bit like a tsunami in the sense that it's this rolling movement of water.
As Irma travels further west in coming days, it will move through warmer waters, which could give even further force to its damaging winds. The hurricane is expected to hit the US coast sometime this weekend, but before then its force will also be felt in Puerto Rico, Cuba and Haiti, which is still recovering from another hurricane late last year. CARE Haiti's Assistant Country Director Claire Sewell says the impact of two hurricanes so close together could be devastating for the country.
We've just come through Hurricane Matthew, which hit us in October of last year, and quite a lot of the southern part of the country was affected by that. And there we saw a huge amount of damage to roads, to livelihoods, to buildings, to schools. And the country has really spent the last year trying to recover from that. Now we're looking at having the northern part of the country be affected by something similar or even worse. So really this is something that could be really quite devastating for Haiti.
Claire Sewell says residents in the remote north of Haiti could be the worst affected.
There are some areas up in the north and especially in the northwest that are extremely remote where it takes a full day to get there and where the roads are quite poor. There's 2 million people living in that area of the country, and those people are likely to be very badly affected by this hurricane. They may have their road access cut off for a number of days, and so this means that responding to this hurricane is going to be quite tricky, I think.
Claire Sewell from CARE Haiti, ending that report from Flint Duxfield. The High Court battle against the same-sex marriage survey is almost over, with the government airing its arguments before the full bench in Melbourne today. The court's expected to deliver its decision as early as tomorrow afternoon. Our reporter Jane Lee has been in court today and she joins me now. Jane, the two groups opposing the survey have argued the finance minister unlawfully advanced $122 million to the Bureau of Statistics to conduct the survey. What did the government have to say about that today?
Yes, Tom, there's a law that says that the finance minister can draw on a pool of money outside of the normal budget processes for contingencies, but only if he's satisfied that there's an unforeseen need to do it. So the Solicitor General, Stephen Donoghue, said today that it all relies on the finance minister's state of mind at the time he advanced the money to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Mr. Donoghue says that his state of mind really was that there was an unforeseen need, and that came about when the government changed its policy from a compulsory plebiscite to a voluntary postal survey on same-sex marriage. So even though the groups say that the Turnbull government had planned for a plebiscite on same-sex marriage, it promised to hold one if elected, it even calculated the fiscal risk of holding a plebiscite in the budget papers, and, you know, also various ministers floated the idea earlier in the year of a postal survey, Mr. Donoghue said that this doesn't mean that he knew that a postal survey was definitely going to form government policy. The minister's also given evidence that he only knew about the Australian Bureau of Statistics, that the Australian Bureau of Statistics would need the extra money on the day he announced the policy, and that was earlier this month. And it was also the same day that the government tried and failed to get a compulsory plebiscite through Parliament. And that was well after the budget.
And the group headed by Independent MP Andrew Wilkie also argues that the ABS cannot lawfully be asked to run the survey. So what was the government's response to that?
Well, the Solicitor General says that under the Constitution, it's uncontroversial that the government has the power to collect statistics, and that has long been said to include opinions. So he gave lots of examples about the history of ABS asking people in the census things like how well they speak English and you know, whether people, what kind of national anthem people wanted and what they thought about their childcare. Those sorts of things are all about opinions. And so he says there was no controversy then and there's none now in the ABS running such a survey.
And what can we expect to happen tomorrow?
Well, as soon as the arguments finished up this afternoon, Chief Justice Susan Kiefel announced that the court would make its orders in the case at 2:15 tomorrow afternoon. So that means that at that time, the court will deliver its answers to questions like whether or not the money was lawfully given to the Australian Bureau of Statistics and whether the Bureau can lawfully run the postal survey. And it's just in time, given the government wants to issue the survey forms next week. But we won't see a full set of reasons for the court's decision until much later.
Jane Lee reporting there from Melbourne. Thank you. Doctors are hailing the development of a new vaccine as an important victory in the fight to protect women against cervical cancer. It's an improved version of Gardasil, which already helps to protect women against some strains of HPV, the virus that can cause the cancer. Catherine Gregory reports.
Being diagnosed with cervical cancer at the age of 22 is not only traumatic but also unusual. And yet, Sarah Marie Cameron was almost prepared for it.
My mum and my sister had it, and I was always told to go and get a pap smear regularly. And at the time, the recommendations were to have them every 2 years, but I was going off my own back every year. And it was actually picked up during a pap smear.
Sarah Marie Cameron also took advantage of a period about 10 years ago when the government provided the vaccine Gardasil to women under 26 for free. The vaccine helps protect against the human papillomavirus, or HPV, which is the most common cause of cervical cancer.
Mine wasn't HPV related. That's not a common occurrence at all. Majority of cervical cancers are HPV related, and that is why this new screening method is so amazing.
She's referring to the new and improved version of Gardasil, which has just been given the tick of approval in a clinical trial involving 14,000 young women in 18 countries. Professor Suzanne Garland was involved in the trial and says this vaccine now protects against 9 strains of HPV instead of the current vaccine, which protects against 4.
So it's a real bonus, whereas we had protection for cancer-causing types, which were 16 and 18, which make up 70%, here we have the additional 5 types, which means that you get a 93% protection against cancer. So, you know, that's an extra 23% cover.
Suzanne Garland is also the Director of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases at Melbourne's Royal Women's Hospital. She explains the new vaccine's other benefit. It only requires 2 instead of 3 doses.
It's cost effective, and we should see huge reductions in disease. Australia's at the lead already worldwide, showing reduction in infection.
Joe Toomer, the chief executive of the Australian Cervical Cancer Foundation, says cervical cancer is the 10th biggest killer for Australian women. He's therefore particularly excited about the new vaccine.
And what we'll see, because we vaccinate boys and girls here in Australia when they're usually in about their first year of high school, by the time
they grow up into their sort of perhaps late 20s, mid-30s, we'll see a reduction in HPV-related cancers, including cervical cancer, by probably about 95%.
The next step is putting the new vaccine under the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. Joe Toomer again.
I would like to see that it just gets swapped over into the national school program for vaccination, which is absolutely free for everybody. So as long as you get it when you're in that first year or so of high school.
The Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Board has already approved the vaccine, and Professor Suzanne Garland points out the decision now rests with the government. In a statement, the Minister for Health, Greg Hunt, says the vaccine is currently being considered for the National Immunisation Program, and he's hopeful it will be included.
Catherine Gregory reporting. Most Australian city dwellers take it for granted that the water they get from their taps at home is safe to drink, wash and cook with. But in regional Australia, the picture's more murky, with a string of towns in Tasmania on permanent boil alerts and tens of thousands of people in regional New South Wales also at risk. Well, documents obtained by the ABC reveal the scale of the problem in Australia's biggest state. Stephen Smiley reports.
Tim Carson and his partner Pip run the Sundeck restaurant in Bermagui on the New South Wales south coast, a region popular with city dwellers who come south to enjoy the pristine landscape. But the serenity doesn't extend to the water coming out of the tap.
It just doesn't have that, you know, sort of clean water taste, quite sort of chloriney and a bit concrete-y.
Because the water looks and tastes so bad, and because the local shire routinely issues boil water alerts, Tim Carson says most people in town have paid for filters.
The ceramic one we've got, it'll actually show the muck that it gathers. It'll actually be on the outside of the ceramic filter, so you can really see it, you know, just turning brown.
According to documents obtained by the ABC, after a lengthy government information request, plenty of people in regional New South Wales have similar experiences. The internal documents issued by the State Health Department show more than 100,000 people have been on protective boil water alerts in the past 5 years. The Bega Valley Shire Mayor, Christy McBain, told ABC local radio in Bega this morning the findings weren't much of a surprise.
We obviously do our own testing, and we know that, you know, after heavy rainfall we usually have incidents, which is why the boiled water notice gets delivered to residents.
It's not just New South Wales where regional communities are relying on water supplies that might be contaminated by agricultural runoff that aren't being filtered. Stuart Kahn is an associate professor at the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of New South Wales.
Regional areas in all Australian states do struggle. Tasmania notoriously has a major problem. I know that there have been a couple of dozen towns in Tasmania that have been on permanent water restrictions for decades now. That's clearly an unsatisfactory situation. We would like to be able to say that we live in a developed country that provides clean, safe drinking water to all Australians, regardless of whether you happen to live in Sydney or some rural and regional remote town.
And while the documents obtained by the ABC suggest the New South Wales government should be doing more, Stuart Kahn says it's the federal government that should also pitch in.
What I'd really like to see is a national approach. We had until recently a National Water Commission, and part of their responsibility was to try and coordinate water management across Australia to make sure that we can have a consistent approach, even just having a consistent approach to how we define safe drinking water would be a big step. The Abbott government abolished the National Water Commission. The justification that was put forward was that the National Water Commission had done its job so well that we no longer needed federal oversight of water in Australia. Clearly, that's a ridiculous suggestion.
Back in Bermagui, Tim Carson says most people in the country have just learned to put up with it.
Yeah, look, when you live in a rural area, I think you sort of get used to that. I mean, I've lived in quite a few places around the Shire where it's just been water off the roof into a tank. And, you know, you sort of just got to make do, or you pump it up from the creek that's nearby. Or yeah.
Bermagui cafe owner Tim Carson ending that report from Stephen Smiley. That's all from me tonight on PM. I'm Thomas Ariti. Here's Elise Morgan with Business PM.
Thanks, Tom. Coming up on Business PM, the energy industry dismisses the hoo-ha over the Liddell power plant as a side issue and calls for the government to come up with a proper energy plan. But first, Australia's economy has hit yet another milestone, marking 26 years without falling into recession. While the corks may not be popping, the latest GDP figures of 0.8% growth for the June quarter was propped up by a pickup in consumer spending and a whopping big rise in government spending on infrastructure. The Treasurer, Scott Morrison, says it's a solid result and points to better days ahead. But the annual growth rate is the weakest since the GFC, and analysts remain concerned about the future. His finance correspondent, Philip Lasker.
Economic growth more than doubled, but economist Carol Austin isn't convinced.
We're bouncing around a sub-trend rate of growth, and I don't think it's clear that we've yet got a cut through.
Quarterly growth jumped from a cyclone-affected 0.3% to 0.8%, but the annual rate remains at its weakest since 2009 of 1.8%. RBC Capital Markets Chief Economist Su Linong says it's well below the economy's average speed.
If you look at what growth has averaged over the last 12 months, on a quarterly basis it's barely 0.5%, so it's still a fairly modest pace of activity.
To Treasurer Scott Morrison, today's numbers are ample proof that Australia is weaning itself off an overdependence on mining.
The solid result in today's national accounts is not based on the reliance or one or even two good stories within the economy, but strength that is more balanced across the board.
The Treasurer also declared that the economy is performing in line or better than the government's budget forecasts.
I anticipate that based on these figures today and other data that has come in, that we will achieve better than the budgeted outcome for the final year for 16-17 on the underlying cash balance.
RBC's Su Linong says there are good reasons to be cautious about the future as some of the growth engines begin to weaken.
We know from the leading indicators that the residential construction cycle will likely peak later this year. So what has been a very key contributor to growth will become less so as this year unfolds.
The other major concern is households' deteriorating savings performance. Australians are saving just over 4.5% of their income, the lowest proportion since the GFC. Not a cause for concern, according to the Treasurer. In fact, the opposite.
Often is an indicator of improving confidence.
But the rundown in savings sends a completely different message to Su Linong, raising doubts about the sustainability of spending.
We think there are a number of headwinds still for the consumer. High levels of debt, rising utility prices, and still what is pretty weak wages growth all round.
The GDP's measure of wages fell 0.3%, a blow that was softened by an increase in the number of jobs. But it underlines the difficulties the government faces in meeting its budget forecasts of 2.5% wages growth this financial year and 3% next financial year. Unfortunately, it's a problem that may be out of the Treasurer's hands, according to Carol Austin.
Wages growth have been quite subdued, and that's consistent with the evidence that's happening around the world. Notwithstanding the very strong recovery in employment in the United States and the big reduction in the unemployment rate, they've had very weak wages growth.
Su Linong says it's not an easy fix.
Whether it's technology, the lack of bargaining power post-crisis, high levels of underemployment and hence greater spare capacity in the labour market, there's a whole multitude of factors here which suggests that wages growth is unlikely to pick up significantly. We're hopeful that we've seen the trough.
So is the government, because it won't take too much to drive businesses and consumers back into hibernation.
Philip Lasker reporting. Well, it's been a highly charged 24 hours in the energy sector, with a very public spat between the Turnbull government and power provider AGL. It kicked off yesterday when AGL boss Andy Veazey knocked back the Prime Minister's request for the company to extend the life of the major Liddell coal power station in New South Wales by 5 years. The AGL boss tweeted he remains committed to closing the plant by 2022 and eventually getting the company out of coal. Former Resources Minister Matt Canavan launched a blistering attack on AGL this morning on AM.
AGL are the biggest hypocrites walking around Australia at the moment. We've got already a significant problem. We really do need the cooperation electricity industry to help solve, and it's not helped by a green agenda which is obsessed with shutting down our most important energy resource.
The government today suggested someone else should buy the plant and extend its life. Victorian-based Delta Energy's name has been put forward, but Delta has told Business PM it's a long way from being seriously interested. The peak body representing power companies says the future of the Liddell power plant is just a side issue, though. The Australian Energy Council says certainty for investors is essential, and that can't happen without an energy blueprint from the Turnbull government. I spoke with the council's Matthew Warren from Melbourne.
Matthew Warren, Senator Matt Canavan says we need a cooperative energy industry. Why won't energy companies just extend the life of coal plants?
Look, there are substantial costs in extending the life of any old coal-fired power station, and it's different for every power station. So ultimately, those decisions are made by the owners of those assets, and if we need to extend, then we can. And that comes down to what are the conditions under which we seek to extend their lives. And that's what's missing here. We don't have that plan. We don't have a strategy we're delivering against to see if extending a specific power station is the best option.
What do you mean by that? You need a CET, or you need the government to offer subsidies to keep these going?
Well, it will depend. I mean, we're happy with the Finkel recommendations as a blueprint for delivering the rules for the grid in the 21st century. And then when we're talking about, well, what will be the role of an old power station? It may be what we call strategic reserve. It may sit in the background and be brought on for summer heat waves. And how would we make sure that power station is ready and financially viable so its owners can keep it available for the markets?
So is that a yes or a no to subsidies?
There are different types of payments that you may need to make to keep a power station as strategic reserve, where it only runs for two or three weeks a year. And that's one of a number of options which we haven't even talked about yet.
How helpful is the public dispute between the government and AGL over the ageing Liddell power station?
I mean, these are commercial discussions, you would think, which are best conducted in private, and logically they will be. So the business, AGL in this case, you know, to speak for it, they've already made quite clear commitments about what they plan to do, and they've been very transparent about their plans.
AGL boss Andy Veazey has indicated that he is prepared to sell Liddell to a responsible party. Who would be a responsible party?
Look, I think that's really for AGL to answer. Our concern primarily is that all these transactions are done as part of a broader strategy that we haven't designed yet. We think that there is a role for extending the life of coal-fired generators if that's the best way of keeping the grid secure as we decarbonise it and keeping prices down.
A lot of your members have committed to exiting coal and reducing emissions. So does looking at extending the life of coal-fired power stations fly in the face of those commitments?
Look, I mean, we're fundamentally interested in delivering a reliable, secure and affordable system for our customers. And we need to do that in the context of reducing emissions significantly this century. So whatever gets that outcome, that's the best deal for our customers, is something that we will entertain.
AGL has today confirmed it will close Liddell in 2022. It pumps just under a gigawatt into the network each year. So what plans does the industry have to fill that hole, and can it be done by 2022?
We can replace assets if we can invest, and we can't invest without there being a clear policy blueprint for climate and energy in Australia, and that's what's missing. Investment has just been chilled on these kind of assets for the past 10 years. And until we get that framework, then we can't invest behind those assets.
Matthew Warren, thank you.
Thank you.
Australian shares lost value today, led by a heavy sell-off in the banking sector. The All Ords and the ASX 200 lost around a third of a percent. The Australian dollar has eased since the release of the slightly weaker than expected economic growth figures. A short time ago, it was worth 79.87 US cents, after briefly going above 80 US cents earlier in the day. And that's all for Business PM. I'm Elise Morgan. Good night.